Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And there's nothing like a sad song, is there?
You and me against the world. Sometimes it feels like you and me against the world.
I intend to speak in opposition to Obamacare. I intend to speak in support of defunding Obamacare until I am no longer able to stand.
Remember when the circus came to town and you were frightened by the clown?
Only on The Takeaway, right? That's Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and the legendary Robert Goulet in a rare duet. We're going to talk about the political circus in the U.S. Senate a little later this hour and how brain scientists are learning that sad music can often be the high point of your day. Also, the voice of the possible next president of Afghanistan, exclusively on The Takeaway, the radio program that's dedicated to...
Think about the days of me and you. Of you and me against the world.
But enough of that. If you've been paying attention to the theatrics in the U.S. Senate, it's as simple as this.
Any member of this body that votes for cloture on this bill will be voting to allow the majority leader to fund Obamacare on 51 votes. I think that vote's a mistake. I think that vote disserves our constituents. I think that vote hurts the people of America.
And if you're having a hard time understanding what Senator Ted Cruz is saying, you aren't alone. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
We'd all be hard-pressed to explain why we were opposed to a bill we were in favor of. And invoking cloture on a bill that defunds Obamacare, doesn't raise taxes, and respects the Budget Control Act, it strikes me as a no-brainer.
The attempt to attach defunding of the Affordable Care Act to the overall federal budget and risk a government shutdown is a road many in the Republican Party do not want to go down, while Ted Cruz, sounding like General Schwarzkopf and perhaps looking more like General Custer, is going to take this as far down the road as he can. Is it a matter of principle and philosophy within the GOP, or has Ted Cruz hijacked the U.S. Senate to produce an extended presidential campaign commercial? What's your explanation of what's going on? Love to hear it. 877-8-MY-TAKE. But joining us now, Ron Christie, Republican strategist and former special assistant to President George W. Bush, and Ben Domenech, senior fellow at the Heartland Institute and publisher of The Federalist. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
It was a pleasure.
So is this a war in the party? Is this tactics? Ron, let's start with you.
Well, I don't think it's a war within the party, John. I found it very interesting the last couple of days that some of the establishment Washington types were saying that Ted Cruz had hijacked the party and that he was trying to make this all about his 2016 presidential campaign. I think what this shows actually is a unification of conservatives. Conservatives have rallied against Obamacare. It didn't get any votes in the House when it passed. There were 178 Republicans who voted against it. Didn't get any Republicans who voted for it in the Senate. And I think what Ted Cruz is trying to do, now let's be honest, is this a political stunt? Yes. Does this have any chance of actually defunding Obamacare? No. But what I think it is doing is telling conservatives we need to rally behind the effort to get rid of this bill.
Ben, your view.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think when you look at filibusters generally, they don't tend to actually change the policies that they're designed to change. You look at Wendy Davis in Texas, you look at Rand Paul talking about drones. And I think it's a mistake to sort of evaluate what Ted Cruz is trying to do here based on a change in policy. Instead, he's trying to highlight an issue, change the focus of conversation, and I think engage in a real sort of forthright populist attack on the president's health care law because he views the people as being on his side. I think that that's something that's worth doing regardless of whether the policy changes. And additionally to that, I don't think that the House leadership has a view. You sometimes see a divide between sort of establishment Republicans and conservatives that one view is more legitimate or has more of a chance of success than the other. I don't think that House leadership really believes that their own plan of approach, which is tying delay, of course, to the debt ceiling, has any more of a likelihood of success in forcing President Obama to the negotiating table than Ted Cruz's own stunt, as Ron says. So because of that, I think it is something worth doing.
Well, Ben Dominic and Ron Christie, since you both seem to be in a certain amount of agreement, I'm going to have to play devil's advocate here. this is a complete waste of time. It may be a populist exercise, and it may be a political stunt that's, you know, has precedent in the Senate, but isn't the way to do this basically introduce a new bill, pass the budget, move forward, introduce a new bill, amend Obamacare, change it, repeal it, use the congressional process as it was meant to be used?
Mm-hmm. Of course, but that's the sort of thing that you have to do when you have the votes to do it. I think that one of the things that we should keep in mind is sort of the context of the vote when Harry Reid and Hillary Clinton, John Kerry and Barack Obama all cast votes to cut off funding for the Iraq War. It wasn't designed under sort of the guise that, or nor did they promise their base that it would actually end the war. It was taking a stand against something that their base believed, you know, really represented something awful and horrible. And I think that from the perspective of Ted Cruz and his supporters, the same is true.
Do you really want to make the comparison between Obamacare and the fiasco of the Iraq War in 2006?
I absolutely do, and I have in the past, in the sense, not in the sense of sort of the outcomes for the American people necessarily, but in terms of the way that the base in each respective party views the issue, which is one of, you know, essentially a core challenge to not just the future of the country, but to everything that they believe America represents.
Ron Christie?
Well, let me take this from a different tack, John. I think when you asked a few moments ago if this is a waste of time, I think what Ted Cruz is doing is actually quite politically astute. If you look back to the 2010 elections, Republicans were able to win 63 seats in the House and, of course, propel John Boehner to the speakership. And Republicans gained 763 statewide seats across the country, which then, of course, gave the Republicans control of many of the state legislatures. So I think what Ted Cruz is doing is setting up a dynamic for the 2014 midterm election, which could propel more Republicans to office, both at the state and the federal level. So a waste of time, maybe in the short term for, you know, putting pages in the congressional record. But I think this is setting up for a larger battle that Republicans are poised to win.
Well, if it's about the 2014 election, Ron Christie, why is Mitch McConnell, who's up for election in a tough race, why is he so annoyed at Ted Cruz about this?
Well, again, I think it goes back to what I was saying at the outset. I think the Republican establishment, and I would put Minority Leader McConnell in that column. I'd put many of the people that you see on TV and hear on the radio in that column. They don't like disrupting the status quo. They like to get along and ease along to get along. And I think Ted Cruz is, frankly, a breath of fresh air, given what we've seen from Republican leadership in the last several years.
All right, to both of you, Ron Christie, is Mitch McConnell dead in the water? And is Ted Cruz suddenly the front runner for 2016? Ron Christie, then Ben Dominic.
Oh, I think McConnell will win in Kentucky. And I think that Ted Cruz, along with Marco Rubio and several others, are positioning themselves for a 2016 bid.
I certainly think that Mitch McConnell will survive this election. I think that Ted Cruz ultimately may not choose to run this time, in a surprise to some people. I think that this moment, though, is a critical one in highlighting the difference in tactics and the difference in willingness to fight on the issue of Obamacare.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. Ben Dominic, senior fellow at the Heartland Institute, publisher of The Federalist, and Ron Christie, Republican strategist and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
This is The Takeaway.
When Americans tried it, they discovered they did not like green eggs and ham, and they did not like Obamacare either.
Senator Ted Cruz quoting Dr. Seuss as part of his effort to stall everything in the U.S. Senate. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is with us. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So not only was Dr. Seuss evoked, just about every other literary reference in Ted Cruz's brain was evoked. What do you think is going on here? And what did you make of what Ben Dominic just said, that he doesn't think Ted Cruz is going to run in 2016?
Hey, Ted Cruz went from green eggs and ham to Ayn Rand, referencing the Rebel Alliance versus the Empire in Star Wars, and told Mike Lee, "I am your father." That actually happened on the Senate floor. So you're right. Ted Cruz has done all of the references that we love. It's been quite a debate.
But he's compared himself to Darth Vader?
Not himself. No, in fact, he compared the Obama administration, more accurately, the Washington establishment. He was actually making a salient point, which is that people who stand up and fight against a power and oppression and tyranny tyranny, as he called it, reminded him of a reference that people of his age group would be familiar with, the Rebel Alliance versus the Galactic Empire.
Well, he's still out there. Let's listen. Here's exactly an example of just the kind of thing you've been listening to for many hours now. Here's Senator Ted Cruz in remarks on the Senate floor.
I'm reminded of a children's story. My wife, Heidi, and I are blessed to have two little girls, Caroline and Catherine, age 5 and 2. And one of my favorite children's stories, actually from when I was a kid, was The Little Engine That Could. The Little Engine That Could, the train going up that said over and over again, I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. You know, I have to say, if you listen to a lot of members of this body, the message would be simple, that little engine can't.
Great technique, sentences that don't end, lots and lots of commas, never a period.
John, Ted Cruz is limited here. He can't do the Jimmy Stewart style open-ended filibuster. He will be cut off at noon under the Senate rules. Technically, this is not a filibuster, although that argument has gotten kind of semantical. The Senate is going to vote right after Ted Cruz is cut off around noon, and they'll vote to get onto this bill. Ted Cruz is going to have another opportunity to mount a long speech if he wants to. It's unclear if he will. And it's also unclear how long this debate is going to go, and that's becoming important. Here's why. There is a little bit of Republican pressure now, more than a little bit, on Ted Cruz behind the scenes to not use every minute that's available to him under the rules. Why? That would get the CR, which strips out Obamacare, passed on Sunday, sometime on Sunday. It would then have to go back to the House, and John Boehner would be jammed up against a Sunday midnight deadline to avoid a government shutdown, and it's not clear where the votes are. They're saying to Cruz, hey, you've done great. You've made a great point. You'll be out there for, you know, close to 20 hours, if not more. It's close to a record breaker, although not quite. Don't use all of your time because Republicans are going to get jammed here. And if you give Boehner a little more time, we may be able to get a little bit more out of Democrats in the brinksmanship and the negotiations here. Maybe repeal a medical device tax or something like that. So step down if you would. It's unclear if he's going to listen or where that pressure is going to go.
CR being, of course, the continuing resolution, and they're running out of patience and running out of time. So every minute really counts. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, keep watching.
Vote this afternoon.
Yes, indeed.
I would be sad because you left me all alone. I would be sad because the lies that you had told.
Later this hour, we are talking sad songs and why they actually don't make you all that sad, according to some psychologists who are researching the matter. What is your favorite sad song? From Grand Prairie, Texas, the Abbott Brothers, I Would Be Sad, takes me back to the month my boyfriend and I of 3 years broke up. I may or may not have listened to the song on repeat for days. That's what you're listening to there.
Settle down with you, although I know it's not something that you were asking me to do.
Call us at 878-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Send us your sad song. Find us, too, at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Next week, before the official launch of the Affordable Care Act, we're taking any questions you might have about its rollout and implementation. What confuses you about the new system? What do you need to know more about to cover you or family members? Send us your questions. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post them to our facebook.com/thetakeaway page. Neera Tanden, who served as senior advisor for health reform at the Department of Health and Human Services, will be on with us to answer your questions.
I would be sad because the lies that you had told me. I would be sad.
During General Assembly week in New York City, reality gets a little warped. It's as though all the bright stars and political heavyweights from all over the world in such close proximity distort time and space. For a moment yesterday, I found myself at the center of the upcoming presidential race in Afghanistan. I was speaking to the visiting foreign minister of Afghanistan, Dr. Zalmay Rasool, who many believe has a chance to succeed Hamid Karzai as the president next year. I compared him to Hillary Clinton, with whom I said he had one thing in common.
You both get asked whether you're running for president. I suspect your answer is more candid than hers. Are you running for president?
Not as candid as you think. I think you know the deadline for registration for candidacy in Afghanistan is going to be the 6th of October. And I think by 7th of October, everybody will know.
I see.
Rasool was being interviewed by me at a closed event before a live audience at the Asia Society in New York last night. It was a chance for him to talk about the hard road his country has traveled in the past 12 years in its war with the Taliban and to look at the future. For instance, will the Taliban be in the next government?
First of all, I think it is crucial and vital for the future of Afghanistan that the election should happen on time. It is the first time, as I mentioned in our history, that a transition of power will go from one elected president to another political exit. And that's crucial, because if he succeeds to have an election in which the result is accepted by the majority of the Afghan people, I firmly believe that the democratic process will be rooted in the Afghan society forever.
What is your view? President Rouhani today of Iran was very critical of the U.S. drone program throughout the region in South Asia, including Afghanistan. Do you think that the drone program of the United States, if it continues beyond 2014, is a threat to Afghanistan sovereignty?
You know, as I mentioned, we are at the moment at a critical point of discussion with the United States about the bilateral security agreement. The bilateral security agreement means that the presence of certain number of U.S. forces in Afghanistan and certain bases, the reason of them is to help train and equip Afghan national security forces, but also for the continuation of war against terrorism. Now, what you are discussing at the moment is to define the terrorism. Who is terrorist, who is not terrorist? I think that is something that we are under discussion, and by hope that by end of October, we will finalize that.
The U.S., of course, has a track record of wanting to define terrorists on its terms, not necessarily on the terms of some of its partners. Is this a tough negotiation?
It's not a tough negotiation. It is a serious negotiation because, you know, the fight against terrorism is not only in the benefit of Afghanistan, it's the benefit of the world, the United States. The reason that the United States came to liberate Afghanistan in 2001, it was the attack in New York. So the fact that that the terrorism has provoked these things, we need to have a common definition.
What will it take in this new election? What will a leader need to have to unite this country of so many traditional divisions over the last three decades and to move it forward as a, you even used the term, post-ethnic Afghanistan?
First of all, I think Afghanistan has no ethnic problem today. Of course, it's formed by ethnic group, like a lot of other countries are formed from ethnic groups. The fact that Afghanistan is kept within its geography because of the United Afghan people. But I firmly believe that in Afghanistan today, we have, and that's, we are proud to have different ethnic group, but there is no ethnic problem in Afghanistan. That's something that portrayed outside Afghanistan a long time. But inside Afghanistan, you have traveled a lot. You don't see any problem between our ethnic brothers.
Although you do see people called warlords who acquire largesse, whether it's military, economic, and try to organize either geographically or along ethnic lines. Is 2014 a moment of unemployment for the traditional warlords who have determined power in so many places in Afghanistan?
First of all, the warlords do not represent the Afghan people. So I think more we advance toward a more democratic Afghanistan, more our kids go to school. I mentioned to you when we came to Kabul in the end of 2001, the girls or boys who had 8 years or 9 years old now are 20 or 21 years old, you know. They have access, as you mentioned, to the internet, to the Facebook, Twitter. They have 36 channels of television that they're watching every night. And over 65% of the Afghan population today are younger than 25 years old. So this very important social force for the future of Afghanistan. And we're going to build Afghanistan with this youngster, not the old one.
A very wise person in Kabul once said to me that the Afghan people are entrepreneurs of misfortune and that they are able to turn crisis into stability and national identity, but that they would love to have the chance to be entrepreneurs of a growing economy. Is this generation the generation that you believe will emerge for the first time in 30 years from war?
Definitely. You know, 11 years is not a long time in the history of the country. And you said yourself that the Afghanistan of 2000, if you compare Afghanistan of 2000 to Afghanistan of 2013, you cannot compare it. And you mentioned yourself that there was no girl in school, that women were not considered as a human being in Afghanistan, that all that achievement that you have made is within 12 years. And 12 years is not a long time in a country that came from ground zero.
You know, it's an amazing week here in New York with the talk of a possible new relationship between the United States and Iran. That would certainly have repercussions for your region. It's also an extraordinary moment in history in the sense that as we speak, Syria, Egypt, Libya, and other nations are struggling with the daunting task of nation building, a path that you've been on for 12 years.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about this sense of change between the U.S. and Iran, and any advice for the nations who are looking at a very long road ahead to build the kinds of national success that you're beginning to experience in Afghanistan.
First of all, Iran is a neighbor of Afghanistan. We have a long historical, linguistic, and religious relation with Iran. And Afghanistan cannot be peaceful and stable without having a good relation with Iran. To your second part, more there is a better relation between Iran and the United States, I think the region and Afghanistan will benefit from it, and everybody will benefit from it. And I hope that this emergence of a new view in Iran will provide an environment in which our region will benefit from it.
Visiting Foreign Minister of Afghanistan, Zalmay Rasool, speaking to me in New York yesterday.
Super genius. It is intelligence, which is the ability to learn from experience.
Exercising parts of our brain.
What sounds to you like a big load of trashy old noise is, in fact, the brilliant music of a genius, myself.
Talk about big news. How about you get a phone call, perfect stranger, says, hey, you get $625,000 from a foundation to be paid over 5 years, no strings attached. Well, that's the MacArthur routine every year, and 24 individuals received that very phone call this morning. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation awarded 13 men and 11 women the MacArthur Award with that money, no strings attached. Traditionally, it's been $500,000 awarded since 2000. Jeremy Denk is one of the 24 for this year. Mr. Denk is a concert pianist on the faculty at Bard College Conservatory of Music. Congratulations, Jeremy.
Thanks very much.
And, you know, pianist, schmianist, right? There's a dime a dozen. They're all over the place. But in your case, you really have become known as someone who is a terrific player, spectacular player, in fact, but also someone who thinks very, very thoughtfully about the intersection of music and life and culture and philosophy. What do you think the MacArthur Foundation is trying to tell you to do over the next 5 years?
I wish I had any idea what they were trying to tell me to do, but I'm assuming part of the message is sort of keep doing what you've been doing and pursue the things that interest you, which is, unfortunately, that's very wide-ranging, so it's hard for me to figure out exactly what I'm going to do with all this freedom that they've given me.
What, Jeremy Denk? You're caught speechless because you've just received a call that you've won a MacArthur?
Yeah, unusually speechless, actually. Of course, I have this sort of dual streams. One is piano playing, and I have so many interesting projects in mind of pieces that I want to learn and pieces that I want to commission, but there's also the writing end of my life, and I'm sort of working on a big book right now, so there's lots of dreams and possibilities, I guess.
What was it like to get the call?
Well, I was actually on the Stairmaster at the New York Sports Club, drenched in sweat when I got it, so it was a lot. I had to run back home and talk to them more privately, and instantly my brain was sort of racing about how it was going to change my life, and also thinking about, like, you know, when I started playing the piano when I was five and all the time from then till now, and all the paths that led to this point.
That practicing was worth it, Jeremy.
Tell me, if I was at the gym next to you on the Stairmaster, just staring ahead at some mindless TV, would I have noticed that you got an extraordinary phone call?
I'm not sure. They asked me if I they were from the MacArthur Foundation. They said if I was able to have a confidential conversation. And my brain sort of went into a strange place, and I just said, no, I let me call you back in 10 minutes. So I don't think you would have noticed. I didn't scream or faint or anything.
So I would have just thought, oh, well, there's a guy who can't finish his workout. What a loser.
Yeah, or there's an annoying guy on his cell phone at the gym, maybe.
Well, let's not annoy people on the way out here. This is you playing Bach Partita number 3.
Oh, yeah, sounds like it, yeah.
All right, Jeremy Denk, congratulations, and we'll let people listen to you on the way out. Have a great year.
Thank you very much.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Brain is hardware. Our personalities are all the software. Mental illness has the same quality. The brain hardware dysfunctions that produce paranoia, neurosis, delusions, and extreme anxiety find their software roots in culture and the world around us. In the 1800s, Parisian mental hospitals were filled with patients claiming to be Napoleon. And American mental patients worried that Soviet spies were reading their thoughts from space during the 1950s. And you might say this is the sound of your brain on TV.
It was incredibly terrifying, like all-consuming, where I thought everyone was picking me apart and everyone was watching every single facet of my life on television. So it was like having no privacy. I would be anxious, and the anxiety would cause me to have more delusions, and then the delusions would give me more anxiety, and it was sort of a vicious cycle.
That's Nick Lotz, a man profiled in the New Yorker magazine, a man who believed that everywhere he went, he was on camera being filmed for a reality TV show. Nick was actually diagnosed with Truman Show Syndrome. The movie The Truman Show becomes the plot line for an actual brain dysfunction.
The whole thing was that I was being recorded, and I didn't know who was recording me. I couldn't listen to the recordings, and it was all like a secret kind of cult of recorders who were going around recording me and putting me on television somewhere where I couldn't watch it.
New Yorker writer and editor Andrew Moranz wrote the profile of Nick for The New Yorker, and when we spoke to him, he marveled at how in recovery, Nick Lotz has no problem being on this radio reality show.
He is glad to be on your program because he knows it's your program and he knows who you are, but as soon as it becomes a shadowy cabal of people recording you against your will, it's a different thing. Now, entertainment used to be one thing. It used to be you come onto a soundstage and there's a live audience and it's broadcast live on television. Then it shifted again and again to where we have Big Brother that's being aired 24 hours a day on the internet. So there's always been mental illness and it's always found a form that fits the day, but it is also possible that the proliferation of technology is making more people ill than otherwise would be.
But it's certainly the case that technology enables you to acquire another personality, to plausibly inhabit that personality.
Right. Well, one of the things that comes up when I was reporting the piece is that the line between bizarre delusions and non-bizarre delusions is no longer very respected within psychiatry. So there used to be an idea that there are some delusions that are possible or plausible and some that are not, right? And those lines are blurring now that, you know, people who think their phones are being tapped are probably right.
And it is also the case that the rational truth of a delusion makes it harder to diagnose, harder to even describe these various mental illnesses.
Right. And the borders between screen and real life become more porous every day. I mean, what you said publicly on Facebook or what you thought privately or what you typed in your phone versus what you wrote in your diary, all these things get blurrier and blurrier.
which came first, Truman or the show? So in a sense, the makers of the movie The Truman Show are doing psychiatrists a favor by creating a coherent box to put various kinds of symptoms in.
Sure. And there were you know, Twilight Zone episodes about the fear of nuclear winter that were responding to politics and that were also forming the politics of the future. You know, that we've always had that kind of relationship with our fictional media.
Nick represents that category of individual whose delusion is plausible but possibly not rational.
Sure, but his delusion wouldn't have been plausible 15 years ago, so those lines shift all the time. Part of what made Nick's illness, ironically, worse, more potent, was the fact that he was so aware and alert to what was going on politically and also alert to how entertainment works. And when we drove around together in Ohio, we saw things like little security cameras on traffic lights, and we would kind of both laugh about it because we were both noticing it, you know, from slightly different perspectives, but also from, you know, from our different contexts, we kind of ended up understanding it the same way. I mean, there have always been mentally ill people since the dawn of civilization. The question is, what form does it take?
Andrew Marantz is the writer of Unreality Star, a profile in The New Yorker of Nick Lotz, who suffered from the Truman Show delusion. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What were the signals yesterday? Did you hear any at the United Nations General Assembly?
The realization of democracy consistent with religion and the peaceful transfer of executive power manifested that Iran is the anchor of stability in an otherwise ocean of regional instabilities.
It's Iran's anchor of stability president, Hassan Rouhani, speaking yesterday at the United Nations. His speech was tough, but with none of the code words of his predecessor, who once delighted in calling for Israel's destruction or disputing the Holocaust. President Obama, who spoke first yesterday before the UN General Assembly, used less coded language to make the point that resolving the Iran nuclear issue might be within reach, and he ordered his Secretary of State into action.
And given President Rouhani's stated commitment to reach an agreement, I am directing John Kerry to pursue this effort with the Iranian government in close cooperation with the European Union, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Russia, and China. The roadblocks may prove to be too great, but I firmly believe the diplomatic path must be tested.
And also from President Obama, there was another subtler, tantalizing signal.
The ban against the use of chemical weapons, even in war, has been agreed to by 98% of humanity. It is strengthened by the searing memories of soldiers suffocating in the trenches, Jews slaughtered in gas chambers, Iranians poisoned in the many tens of thousands.
President Obama is referring there to the Iranians killed by chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, in which Iranian soldiers were slaughtered with chemical weapons by the Iraqi military with the assistance of the CIA, who reportedly helped with the targeting of those weapons. Is this a thinly veiled admission of something that pushes the diplomatic momentum forward? Joining us now is journalist Laura Secor, who has covered Iran for The New Yorker since 2005 and is author of a forthcoming book about Iran. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So did you hear that reference to chemical weapons victims of Iran and think of it as particularly significant in any way?
I did. I thought that it's actually working on two levels. On the one hand, it is it's an acknowledgement of an atrocity committed against Iranians that was largely ignored at the time. And there is a continuing grievance on the part of many in Iran and within the Iranian regime against the United States for both assisting in targeting, as you say, and for saying nothing.
So that message goes directly to the heart of people on the streets of Tehran.
It does. It also has another dimension that has to do with the Syrian conflict. The Iranians are in a difficult position right now. If it can be proven that Assad is responsible for the use of chemical weapons against Syrian civilians, that puts Iran in a very uncomfortable position continuing to support the Syrian government.
the center of what seems like the possibility for some sort of new relationship between the U.S. and Iran, it seems to me, was on the nuclear matter. And I'm wondering if you could characterize the initiative that seemed to be announced yesterday, sending Secretary of State Kerry off to try to get an agreement with all of these countries to possibly lift sanctions and possibly create some sort of way of verifying that Iran has only peaceful nuclear technology.
Yeah, that is really the big news from yesterday's events. We're looking at a high-level initiative of diplomacy on both sides. On Thursday, there will be a meeting of the P5 plus one that should include Secretary Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif. So that would be a high-level meeting that the likes of which has not taken place in a very, very long time between these two countries.
You know, I was speaking with the Afghan foreign minister yesterday, and in remarking, as many diplomats were, about this Iran sort of buzz that's going on in New York this week, he said, you know, there is precedent for the Iranians cooperating with the United States, and that was in the beginning of the Afghan war when Iran and the U.S. actually met in Bonn to try to create the new Afghan government. So there are interesting sort of tantalizing signs that the precedents have been established and cooperation can actually happen here.
That's absolutely true. And it's a very, very delicate process, as we learned then and we're seeing now. It's delicate politically on both sides. We have in Iran a government that is factionalized, and where we're seeing right now what seems to be a unity of purpose that is new and promising. But we can also tell from President Rouhani's remarks that he's trying to thread a needle politically. He has to cover his right flank as well as Obama has to cover his. So in Afghanistan, the famous story is that after cooperating with the United States on the agreement over the Afghan situation, the Iranian government was undercut by the Axis of Evil speech. Mm-hmm. And we have, going forward, to be very mindful of the signals that we send that can undermine the process that we're putting forward today. And the Iranians have to do the same.
Can progress be made separately on the nuclear issue without entailing any more complicated issues? In other words, is that a kind of a lockbox diplomatically that they could actually easily accomplish? Or is it the hard one they're doing first?
My suspicion is that it will not be handled alone, simply because there are so many outstanding issues between the United States and Iran. I think on the nuclear issue, the contours of an agreement are kind of clear to a lot of people on both sides. And the question of how they can be achieved and what concessions need to be made by whom in order to get us there is one that I think should at least involve some maneuvering that has a broader vision and more imagination.
And we'll see if that's the discussion later this week. Laura Secor, journalist who has covered Iran for The New Yorker since 2005, author of a forthcoming book about Iran. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be talking about sad songs, and there's some science that suggests sad music doesn't actually make us sad. It's more complicated than that. But we are asking you, what is your favorite sad song? What does it remind you of?
I come from down in the valley where Mr. when you're young, they bring you up to do like your daddy done.
One of you from Philadelphia chose that song, The River. It reminds me of my own rural youth and having so many peers with a future just like their father, living paycheck to paycheck and never escaping the life which they were born into. We're getting great stories for you on this. 8778, my take is our number. Tell us your sad song and the story behind it at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Scientists have great jobs, don't you think? They get to figure out why the universe exists, they get to cure cancer, and they get to find out why this song hits us so hard emotionally. Ooh, there's a sad song. Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber. But in a recent study published in the journal Frontiers of Psychology, researchers tried to find out what sad music is all about. They played music in minor keys to participants, and what they found was that while participants could perceive music as sad or gloomy or tragic, they'd use those adjectives anyway, what they felt were emotions they described as romantic or fascinated or animated. Sad music could be the high point of your day. Who knows a lot about music? Well, Jeff Spurgeon does. He hears a lot of sad and happy music. Morning host for WQXR joins us to share his thoughts on this study and on this whole idea of sad music.
Hey, John.
Did I bum you out with that adagio for strings there?
Well, I think you illustrated the exact point. I think it's very simple. Sad music makes us experience beauty.
Ah.
And so the trick is, and I think actually that I read the abstract of this study, and I think that they said it. The abstract guys said that sad music produces ambivalent feelings. Music enables us to feel two things at once, sad and happy, so that the beauty in the music comforts us, the sadness we feel, but there's beauty too. So we get both of those things going on at the same time.
So it's kind of like why you really love the slow dance at the end of the prom, right? Because
sure.
The music is sad, but you're kind of happy because
yeah.
It's the slow dance.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get some examples here. This is one you requested, and let's just talk about it.
This is not sad.
No.
But it is music that carries powerful emotion.
Huge. I mean, helicopters coming in Vietnam.
Exactly.
You know, whatever.
So, or you could play this before the NFL team rushes out on the field.
Exactly.
I'm guessing they use rock and roll for that, but it's the same thing. It's music that we understand the emotion behind. And I think all of this education, all these perceptions we have about music, comes from our experience watching the movies and television. We have been taught what a particular musical idea means emotionally. We take those cues from the movies. So we hear the Ride of the Valkyries, and we know we're going into battle.
All right, but the sad song apparently is more complicated because it really evokes complicated parallel tracks. Here's one of the tracks the study actually used to... they didn't want familiar music. They just wanted abstract sad music. Here's one of the things they chose. Jeff, where's your safe space? Is it the studio at WQXR?
I'm very safe there, yeah.
As is always the case, something like this provokes us to ask our listeners, you know, what their favorite sad song is.
Excellent.
And everybody has one. What's yours?
Shenandoah, I think, is one that everybody knows, and it illustrates the point very well, that it's sad but beautiful.
Well, let's hear a version of Shenandoah. Nostalgic. Who's playing that?
It's Keith Jarrett.
You're kidding.
Nope.
Mr. Jazzo.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And he's playing it straight, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a song that's not in a minor key. We think of minor keys as being the sad song. This is a major key song, Shenandoah.
Right. Why does it make us feel... Well, it doesn't make us feel sad. It's home. It makes you feel like home.
Right, right.
That's great.
But it's also about separation. A lot of the verses in this song are about, I'm bound away across the wide Missouri. I'm leaving you. So the separation idea is there, too.
I have a feeling this listener's suggestion is literally sad.
Hi, my name is Naomi, calling from Yuma, Arizona. One of my favorite sad songs is Billy Joel's Lullaby. Back in the day, a boyfriend playing that song for me when we were breaking up.
Good night, my angel, time to close your eyes.
Hoping that it would make me feel better, which it didn't, but... It was probably the best song to try that with.
I think I know what you've been asking.
That story is breaking my heart.
I know. I have to pull myself out of a fetal position just to continue here.
Did you ever use music in a relationship that was ending to try to help a segue?
No, but I have songs from relationships that have been ruined by that experience, yeah.
Maybe this is one.
Hi, this is Robert from Savannah, Georgia. My sad song was Baker Street by Jerry Rafferty. And my mother had passed away when I was on leave home from the Air Force. That song was just playing at the time, and for some reason it hit a chord with me. And it kind of a song that's resonated throughout my life to this day.
That's the only sax riff I can play also. That's great. That's a good story.
But the wailing saxophone lets you feel that sadness. So it channels your emotion that that he felt at the loss of his mother into that music.
Sax is all about grabbing at your emotions.
You bet.
What do you think? Here's a good one.
This is Daniel from Dallas, Texas. My favorite sad song is Cancer by My Chemical Romance.
Now turn. I'm awful just to see, 'cause all my hairs are abandoned, all my body, all my agony.
The memory that conjures is of my grandmother when she was dying of lung cancer.
'Cause the heart is part of this is leaving you.
So I thought that was going to be a snarky reference,
right.
And wow, what a somber, amazing story. I guess maybe the conclusion here is we're not talking about sad or happy. We're talking about evocative.
Absolutely. It takes you to a place of your own emotions. It allows you to experience an emotion that's already inside you. But the music itself is not sad or happy.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Spurgeon is the morning host for WQXR. More sad songs from you from Richmond, Virginia. Find the River by R.E.M. It's an endgame song about an old man dying. It will be played at my wake. Really beautiful and emotional.
Hey now, little speedyhead. The read on the speedometer says you have to go to task in the city.
These are great stories. From Eugene, Oregon, Long May You Run by Neil Young makes me think of my dad, who passed almost 15 years ago and educated me on classic rock, but I also think of pet dogs who've passed. I think that's what the song is about. I cry whenever I hear it, but the tears are bittersweet because it's also a little comforting. Makes me feel closer to dad, not just sad.
Of memories still to come. We found things to do in stormy weather. Long may you run.
Comforting. Send us your favorite sad songs and what they remind you of. You can always reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.